Shobhi namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. So in talking about the Chenrezig, you're talking about his four arms being the same thing as the four gateways. But the four gateways are an outer guardian and an inner guardian. The outer guardian is when you decide that friendliness is better than being pissed off, more or less. Does that make sense to you? And then the inner doorways are when you think you're being friendly enough and then you find out you're not. Why are you poking him? Why is he poking you?
He feels like picking at me.
Are there just certain things that you say that kind of appeal to him?
You're helping him be appealed. That's really cool.
I just want to remind him that he's being thought of.
So that the outer doorways are your understanding that, so for example, the first doorway is about loving kindness. The outer doorway is you realizing that it's better to be kind, meaning you start with yourself, being honest is being kind, isn't it? And then when that you do that, you do it outside of yourself as well. But then the inner doorway, so that's what the rosary stands for, right? Stands for the threading of one moment of consciousness to the next moment of consciousness by kindness, by wishing to be kind. It's pretty straightforward, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And then once you get that and you start practicing it, there's always going to be something that interferes with it, isn't there?
Seems to be.
Yeah, that's the inner doorway, that's the inner guardian. Where you actually are learning how to hold kindness more important than irritation or sense of failure or dislike. Where you take everything as a guru, you know, who's showing you how to be kind no matter what. Because it's better in the long run. Is that pretty straightforward? Mm-hmm. So the second doorway, which is compassion, The outer guardian is the one that you have to decide, okay, yeah, I do want to be compassionate. And the inner guardian is the one who tells you whether or not you've done a good enough job to go further. So each of the four gateways has these two guards, two guardians. Is that pretty straightforward? Any questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
So For sympathetic joy and equanimity, then,
yeah.
What would the inner guardians be for those?
So, on the page, we will get to it. The third yaksha, page 3. The third yaksha, that's sympathetic joy, is drunk on his partial achievement. He sees everything as awakening. He has the joy of seeing all beings as awakening. Which is sympathetic joy, isn't it? Mm-hmm. When you see everybody headed toward great joy, great blissfulness, he can see how that's the only possible career anyone is really actually on about. He's drunk on he has that realization. He has the realization that samsara is not that different from nirvana, and he can see the Buddha nature of everyone. Is that clear?
Yeah.
And so he has become distracted from complete understanding because he's very involved in less appropriate activities, but he keeps wanting to tell everybody or you know, it's still not the emptiness.
Oh,
there's the wisdom of seeing the awakening that the original mind is pure. Mm-hmm. But there's still the attachment to the one who sees that.
So somebody might become very evangelical about to his insight and realization.
Or about everybody else's.
Of everybody else's, yeah.
In case of sympathetic joy.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? And same with equanimity, fourth place of dancing yaksha, indeed he's hogging the stage. Because he has equanimity. He offers the dance to entertain the transcendent because he understands there's no such thing as amusement. He's no such thing as activity. There is only the continuous dance of impermanence.
But he still thinks he's the dancer.
But he's still attached to the activity of dancing. So these are the last sort of learning curve of making the four states boundless. Loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Which are Chenrezig's four arms. That's straightforward? So shall we read it again to remind you of how bad a writer I am? And you can tell me exactly where I should have written it differently or... Is that good? Any promise? I don't hear any promises.
Maybe.
Okay. The Dagava or Stupa represents manifest transcendence, the awakened body, voice, and mind of the teacher, and the eternal path that has been made clear through his kindness. By walking this path in response to hearing his teachings, we are led into union with him. The symbolism of this structure was described by the Buddha Shakyamuni as showing both the descent of the grace waves of liberation and the joyful ascent to fulfillment. This double flow is imminently present everywhere. The key to unlocking this mystery is the power of awareness. So that's the first thing, to become aware. When our lives are not seen as a precious opportunity, we wander blindly, driven by hunger for satisfaction. This is often referred to as, quote, caught in becoming, end quote. The only way to escape from this powerless state is to recognize the four gates that mark entrance to transcendence. We cannot identify these gates until our own experience leads us to realize three truths. These three are as follows. Desire for what is not present is futile. Desire to be separate from what is present increases suffering. And desire to hold on to present pleasure creates fear. Once this is understood, the feeling of being driven by hope and despair lessens, and renunciation dawns. We quit wishing for the next moment. We start to appreciate the present. That's what renunciation is. Renunciation of becoming. Renunciation of grasping after. But being where you are. There's nowhere else to be. Is there?
Can't be.
With this new seeing comes an aspiration to know for oneself whether there is a more fulfilling way to live our lives. This aspiration turns the mind toward the four gates. Yearning for something more satisfying than material pleasure lessens our unthinking response to the prodding of the four demons who ride on our shoulders from the time we are born. This is a very ancient Buddhist teaching. That as soon as you're born, there are four demons riding on your shoulders. Mm. Hunger, sleep, sex, and breath. And they ride on your shoulders the whole of your life until you learn how to deal with them.
What was the first one, Susan?
Hunger.
Hunger.
So they're just going to be talked about here. These demons represent, first, avarice and grasping for positions and possessions in the hope of maintaining safety. The demon of hunger. Second, clinging to the known because of hating to be disturbed, dislike of change, the demon of sleep. Third, hunger for approval and adoration toward our fear of rejection, the demon of sex. 4.
Obsession
with control by wanting to know everything so we can escape the overwhelming fear of meaninglessness, the demon of breath. They're interesting, aren't they? As long as we experience these insatiable demons as threatening to our happiness, we're caught. When we learn to meet them, they become the 4 outer gateways, transformed into the attributes of prosperity, peace, seduction, and power. When we reach this point, rather than responding to the demon of hunger by grasping for positions and possessions, we are able to transform it into the power of prosperity. How? By becoming aware of all that is presently supporting and nourishing us in this life, this breath, this moment, this experience. In this way, feelings of pride and avarice open into awareness of beauty and the joy of kindness. When we are caught in anger and irritation, it is because the demon of sleep feeds our wish to drift in habituation without being disturbed by change or by something we don't want to happen. No. Something that's interfering with our sense of what we're doing. We have our own little agenda and something doesn't fit it. Is that right? A little bump in the road and we... Using the power of peace, we are able to let the waves of hatred diminish by remembering the truth of impermanence. This lessens our tendency to cling to the known, allowing the mind to open to calm acceptance of things as they are, transforming the desire for sleep into the power of peacefulness. Thus, feelings of hatred are transformed into awareness of spaciousness and compassion. Addiction to bliss, which is symbolized as the demon of sex, causes us to pursue pleasure regardless of how inappropriate that pursuit may become. When that passion no longer triggers us to become oblivious of others, it becomes the beauty of seduction, turning our longing toward a greater goal and inspiring others to also seek truth rather than temporary pleasure. Thus, the passion for union with the all-too-fleeting temporal joy is transformed from self-indulgence to the sweetness of sympathetic joy. Fear of obscurity and grasping for dominance and control are the characteristics of the demon of breath. By knowing the art of true power, we can transform the jealousy that arises when this demon has gained ascendancy, thereby turning the mind to dwell in the calm, still point at the center of the whirlpool of unending activity. This stillness, which is always present within the waves and ripples of interbeing, is never caught by grasping for a fixed identity. In this way, jealousy is transformed into equanimity. The work of transforming these demons into the 4 powers is how one enters and walks through the first level of the path to liberation from suffering. At the second level, these 4 trainings manifest again, but now they appear as the 4 guardian yakshas or wrathful protectors. When as one has learned how to pass these 4, access to the third level of realization is found. The first of these 4 yakshas lives at the base of a great mountain, which is constantly washed by the waves of a vast ocean. This being is furiously trying to prevent the base from being eroded by the waves. Best of Irish luck, huh?
Now, this is an inner demon?
This is the inner guardian, yeah. The outer are demons, the inner are guardians.
Oh, okay.
So you get, well, they sometimes both call guardians, but the outer are more, they're more, we see them more as enemies. You know, they are the really strong manifestation. Hunger, where my hunger is greater than my sense of being present.
Yeah.
rather than now. Now, I'm wanting the my mountain to stay whole, and I'm doing what I can to stop it from eroding, but I still am not looking at impermanence. He is the first of these yakshas, lives at the base of a great mountain. That's his home, right? Mm-hmm. Which is constantly washed by the waves of a vast ocean. The mountain is a little dot. The ocean is coming from all sides. This being is furiously trying to prevent the base from being eroded by these waves. He's still trying for his position. So like, you get a certain degree, it's no longer a full-on demon, it's more like a temporary, you know, okay, you've done very well with loving kindness. You've gotten to the point where you know you prefer it. But every once in a while, something will hit the mountain that you want to live on. And how do you react then?
Right, okay. Now
so it's like the training is two-thirds done up to this point. There's just a third to go. Yeah. So you've already in the gateway, but you haven't got out the other side because this other guardians, one guardian stands at the front and one start guardian stands at the back of the gate.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
And so then the second yaksha, this is for compassion, right? Which is the opposite of anger, right? Mm-hmm. So he's like humming this tune of his favorite mantra. I don't want anything to bother me. 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 And goes into the nice, blissful, I don't want anything to bother me, I don't want anything to bother me, I don't want anything to bother me, and then the string breaks. So second yaksha is turning a rosary, infinitely repeating this chant until the string breaks. So he can repeat his chant if he's just sort of meeting ordinary circumstances, but if an extraordinary circumstance happens, or something that, you know, he thinks he's got under control. The third yaksha is drunk on his partial achievement of realization, so he has become distracted from complete understanding because he's very involved in less appropriate activities. He thinks he's already awakened, so he goes around telling everybody they should worship him. It's a good example.
Getting drunk because it's okay, because he's awakened.
Yeah, or whatever. Drunk on being awakened. In fourth place is a dancing yaksha. Indeed, he's hogging the stage. He offers his dance to entertain the transcendent because he understands that there is no such thing as amusement. But he has not yet let go of activity. One who succeeds in passing these guardians then enters the third level. At this stage, the four activities of loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity become universal in their scope. Now there is no way they can be interfered with. Isn't that beautiful?
Yes.
There is no way they can be interfered with at this point.
So that means there's no going back? Does that mean that?
It means that no, there is no back. That all there are those four reactions to those four circumstances. If something comes up where it's obvious that loving kindness is needed, that just automatically arises. Just the heart just knows it. Or compassion. Nothing can break those. That's what the aspiration is, and it's now been fulfilled. The being is capable of practicing loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity in any circumstance, any time, anywhere, any lifetime.
Okay. I like that job description.
Yeah. Where is the application form? Yeah. This marks the profound beginning of the Eightfold Path. As one traverses this path, it is understood that samsara is not separate from nirvana. We realize that the original mind is pure, and it has always been. And there is an opening to the innate nature of the awakening, which is always present.
But that's not saying that samsara is the same as nirvana.
First of all, samsara is not separate from nirvana.
Right.
It's not separate. If something is not separate, well, how is it different? So let's keep going. Symbolized by the rising energy of the spire, reaching transcendent consciousness. Then the fourth stage, the descent from the crystal to the base, recognizing that neither is nirvana separate from samsara. Immediately follows. The most secret harvest is thus completed. There is nothing to get. There is everything to discover. They say it in the Zen, the original mind is pure. The Ayatana consciousness is like a beautiful, beautiful, huge skating rink. Then a few kids come along and skate on it and they leave scratches. The scratches are like our habituated states. It doesn't change the nature of the ice. We start looking at the habituated, we start reacting to the scratches. But the original mind is the pure clarity of the ice and has always been there. They call the scratches, I love this, adventitious obscurations. I love it because it always brings up in my mind the idea of viciousness. Adventitious always has a tone of vicious to me. Adventitious obscurations. Depending on the circumstance, this habit will come of not wanting to do this or being afraid of doing that, not liking to drive behind somebody who's going too slow, what you were saying, or, you know, whatever, there's always some little trigger that when the circumstances are right, there's that sort of irritation that arises, you know what I'm saying? Anybody doesn't know what I'm saying? You don't know? Yeah. And so, like, that kind of edginess is like a surface mark. But it's not separate from the ice. But we react to it because we like or dislike, or we grasp onto it. The mind is not neutral.
Does that mean?
And the habit of the mind not being neutral is very strong.
What?
No, I've almost forgotten what I was going to say. Does that mean that in some way we wish for the obscuration?
We are habituated to the obscuration.
Okay.
And we don't.
The adventitious.
Yep, yeah, we forget that before we were named, there was still a state of being. And we forget to wonder what that state of being is in the here and now. We get so caught up in who we should be. What are you going to be when you grow up?
The
performance becomes more important than the state of being.
It just feels the way it's said, that it's adventitious for you to meet this obscuration. Is that what it would be?
No, it's an obscuration that takes advantage of the circumstance to arise.
Oh, okay.
Like that.
Okay.
So when this happens and that happens, this will result. When there is this cause and this condition. And we forget that we have choice. Don't we? We fall into the pattern, we forget we have choice. I do, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why on the first page where it says yearning for something more satisfying, third paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
No, in the last sentence of this, the second, last two sentences is the paragraph before. Once this is understood, the feeling of being driven by hope and despair lessens. Because most of the time we're driven by, oh, I'm going to get that, or, oh, I didn't get that. Isn't that true? We go back and forth between the two. And they drive us. And renunciation dawns. With this new seeing comes an aspiration to know for oneself. Is there anything else to do besides chasing after the next moment? Becomes a real question. If I'm not totally busy, does that mean that there's nothing in the world? Nothing to accomplish?
Only logically.
Pardon?
Only logically. I get the logic of it makes sense, but when you're caught in...
When you're caught in it, you're caught.
Yeah.
But, and that sometime or other, enough things don't work that maybe you say, or you do something and then it falls in, and then an earthquake takes it apart.
Then you get your house built and it burns down.
Yeah.
So it's like the question that comes up a lot for me is, am I of any value apart from what I do?
And that's exactly it. With this new seeing comes an aspiration to know for oneself whether there is a more fulfilling way to live. Is there something else beside activity? Which is endless. I wonder, this aspiration turns the mind toward the four gates. So in Buddhism, they don't talk about God or creation. They say, first understand your mind. Because whatever you believe about God or creation is going to be with your mind. So you want to know what kind of trustworthiness your views have. One day you feel one way, the next day you feel the next, right?
Which is, will the real Kathy Sinclair please stand up? Will the real Bob McDonald's,
you know, it's like just continuous, isn't it? One day you're enjoying yourself, the next day you're, right? Who's the real one? They're adventitious obscurations. They obscure the quality of mind. And depending on circumstances, this one arises or this one. So descending up to the, once you have those four gateways, the rest is way more straightforward. Once you understand loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, you actually start preferring them.
Yeah, there's going to be so much peace in
them. Yeah, and peace, compassion, loving kindness, a sense of friendliness and openness, nothing to fear, peacefulness, a joy at whatever you see, whoever you see, really appreciating how everybody is on the path. You don't have to convert anybody. You really appreciate how everybody is moving on the path. And do you think that approval actually translates to others? Have you ever been in love with someone? Could they feel it?
Yeah.
Have you ever had somebody in love with you? Could you feel it?
Yeah.
When there is this sense of admiration for people, and don't they immediately sort of flower a little nicer? Don't they?
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
And equanimity. The realization that, you know, like that statement about there's nothing wrong with the world. What is wrong with it is the way you look at it. You know that piece I gave you before? It is your own imagination that misleads you. Without imagination, there is no world. Did you see those movies on the five senses, six mm-hmm. senses?
Yeah.
And what did you learn from those movies? Maybe I should play him again.
David Suzuki?
I'd love to see him again.
Can I hold this shit real look at that again?
The David Suzuki ones?
Yeah. What did you learn from them?
Mind only.
Mind
everything. Mind is what controls, how can I phrase this? It all comes back to the mind.
And the mind is based on what? The when you see something, what is that based on?
Past experiences.
Past experiences and emotion.
Yep.
Does emotion change?
Yes.
Are there many past experiences?
A few. Yes, there are.
So are you actually seeing what's there? You don't... Maybe not, you can't tell, but you know that what you're seeing is not necessarily what's there.
That's
you're
true.
Seeing what your mind is picking up to see.
Yeah.
Isn't that true?
And we're assuming that I'm assuming that how I see you is the way everybody else sees you.
But it's not true.
But it's not true.
No.
Like, for one thing, I don't even know if what I see as a black sweater is what everybody else calls a black sweater.
That's right. And furthermore, you don't even know whether you're seeing anything that's actually a me.
Yeah.
You're seeing what your experience tells you and that your emotion supports.
Yeah.
And so they say in Buddhism, mind is illusory. It's an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
Your seeing is illusory. Secondly, the illusion is, reality is a projection of the mind. Mind is illusory. The illusion is inexplicable. You can't say it's right. You can't say it's wrong. You can say it's this mind, seeing this based on this emotion and this. It isn't that it isn't there, but it isn't that it is the way you see. So when you understand that about mind, maybe we should see those movies again. Does that interest you?
Oh, yeah.
Because you really do see when they talk about sight and sound and smell and taste that it's not out there, it's in here.
Yeah.
And that we assume it's out there because then there's an I who's looking at it. Well, we don't think that there's an I in here who has decided that it, which is in here also, is out there. Do we?
Yeah.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
And it explains like an Alzheimer's patient. Your mother doesn't recognize you anymore, you know, because
maybe that memory isn't operative right now.
Yeah.
It's gone out to lunch for a little while, and then later it'll come back, and somebody else will remind you of her of you, and she'll call them your name.
Yeah, that's such a traumatic thing for somebody to experience, but like my throwing the banana peel in the sink instead of the garbage and not remember doing it.
It's no different.
It's no different.
No, it isn't. And so what's wrong with the picture is clinging to a sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
Because whatever mind state arises, it always has a past and future history. And it always feels like I have always and I will always. But then the circumstance changes and the next mind state arises. And it always has a past and future. So when you're going through them, you'll always feel like you're one self with the past and future. You don't notice how in this mood, these memories are easier to get. In this mood, these memories are... You ever thought in the middle of a sentence you forgot something and then you started looking for the word and you could feel yourself going through different memories?
Mm-hmm.
And each one of those is a slightly different mind state. But there's an I in each of them. And we bead the eye together, and we think it's a continuous eye. But that's illusory.
What about the memory of that, then? Where does that come in?
Where does memory come in?
Yeah, you're talking about a sequence of events that, like, beads on a string.
Yeah, that's what the memory is. But the memory
is there any actual thing? Is there any actual thing there?
And that's not possible to describe from a Buddhist point of view. They say that's ineffable.
Okay.
You can't say that there is, and you can't say that there isn't.
Okay.
But there is a vast difference between relative truth and absolute truth. Absolute truth is understanding that no inherent identity of all phenomena, most clearly. And secondly, relative truth is realizing that even though there is no inherent identity, in time, when something has come into existence and is occurring and passing away, there is a moment where we all give it a name, but then we cling to that name and think it's going to keep lasting. We don't see this chair dissolving before our eyes. Maybe you feel at my age your body dissolving before my very bones. But we don't feel that the chair is changing all the time. You think, oh yeah, I put that chair there. Yes, that chair. Oh, that's the chair I bought in. But it's not the same chair. It's changed completely. But that's not rational to us. So there is relative truth, which is in relation to these circumstances. This is the chair that you bought. But absolutely, if you start trying to identify what makes it a chair, is the leg a chair? This is for classic meditation. Is the leg what makes it a chair? If you take the leg off, is it still a chair? If you take two legs off, is it still a chair? When, at which point does it stop becoming a chair? And you can't really say, well, the leg is what makes it a chair, or two legs, you know. You can't say any one part of it. It's the use of it that makes it a chair. But the use is temporary, isn't it?
So it's a function.
It's a function.
Okay.
So reality is really a verb, not a noun.
Mm-hmm.
And verbs are moving.
Mm-hmm.
Need, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Is this interesting?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? It makes me happy. Whoever that may be. We'll stop for a sip.
So David Bohm was kind of wrong when he said reality is the thing you think about.
No, he's absolutely right on. Reality is the thing you think about. So what your image is real to you,
uh-huh.
And it's, you believe it's out there. But the word reality, the word thing, and the word think, when you trace their roots back, all three of them come from one root, R-E-S. Reality, thing, and think. In law, they use the Latin word for thing, which is res, R-E-S. The root for the word reality is R-E-S. The root for the word think is R-E-S. They've changed in their pronunciation over the centuries, but all three of those words come from the same root. They're exactly the same thing, reality, thing, and think. Reality is think. Thing is think. Think is reality. Think is thing. That's why that, when he said that, it had such power for me. Because I know the roots of words.
What is the root? Does the root R-E-S, is this Latin? Or?
Yeah.
I think on an email when you put re, that's also
yeah.
From,
yeah.
That's what it's about. Or
yeah.
R-E.
Yeah.
Referring to, refer comes from that.
Yeah.
All kinds of things.
Oh,
R-E-S.
R-E. Refer.
Yeah.
Oh.
R-E-S. And the actual root is R-E-S.
Oh, regarding.
All kinds of things.
Yeah.
Reality is the thing you think about. He was right on. And when he said that, I thought, how Buddhist. It's interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't that it isn't out there, and it isn't that it is out there. It's ineffable. It's beyond description. Because description is relative.
Mm-hmm. The description is relative.
Isn't it? The absolute transcends description. This by Kabori San is more about the absolute.
You need a certain kind of strength to be there, though, I think.
Of letting go.
Yeah.
Of letting go.
Yeah.
It takes a real ability to allow the sense of self to let go and open the mind to totality.
That makes sense.
So the Buddha said, you know, the four Maras, he's sitting there under the tree.
Mm.
And the first Mara comes and says, what makes you think you're good enough to be here? And he touches the earth. And there is this sense of he is not separate from the waves and ripples of planetary motion. He does not hold himself, I am worthy. These are the molecules of the universe. That's how I see the earth witness. Buddha. The in the stories about the Buddha, they say he touched the earth, and then all of these flowers started falling from the trees, and the voice of the earth said, "This is my beloved son, who has given so much of himself that there is nowhere he is not." But that to me means the same thing, that he was not separate from anything. There was no separation. But he, you know, the four fears. What about your family? How are they going to feel if you, you know, met all four of them? And he said afterward in one of the sutras, I used to love reading all the sutras when I lived in Thailand. One of them, he said, oh monks, the sense of fear was so great that tears were coming from my eyes and the hair on my nape of my neck stood on end. And he still sat there because he wanted to see if he didn't fall for any of those hopes and fears, what was the nature of mind? So transcending all of the identities means meeting the four Maras. First Mara of aggregates. Second one, Mara of the emotions, afflictions, I call it. Third Mara of the mind, death. Fourth Mara of ego, son of God. Meet all four of those Maras. Let go of ownership with them. Let go of your...
So the four Maras, I'm trying to think if those are related to the four demons.
No, not the same way. They are more what having the four, having these four demons here. These four gateway demons. Guardians, you mean? The
mm-hmm.
guardians that we've been talking about?
Well, how about the demons on the shoulder?
Yeah, no,
yeah.
They're more... These four demons are more like what you have to go through in order to begin on the path. To really, really start looking at right view, right thought, right speech, right action. And you have to have actually... for the last stage of the path is where you meet the four... These four Maras.
Okay.
At the moment of where you actually decide you want to go beyond self, you want to leave the relative world. Because your question is, what is mind? Mind is where your whole world appears, isn't it? Isn't it? Whether you're in a coma or not, it doesn't matter. It's where your whole personal world appears, in your mind. So, what is the nature of mind? How do I know what I'm looking at? You ever go to a movie with somebody? Did you all ever find exactly the same line, the most interesting line in the movie? Heaven, hell, and earth, no. Isn't that true? You ever meet somebody you hadn't seen for a long while, and then you're walking away and you say to your friend, gee, he's really looking such and such, and your friend says, oh, really? I thought he was looking such and such. And do you have a different view? Yeah. Do you have siblings? Do they have a different history of their family? Yeah. Who's right? No one. Who's wrong? No one. In relative terms, who's right? Everyone. Who's wrong? Everyone. So when Chenrezig is sitting there with his legs crossed, his right leg represents what? Compassion. His left leg represents what?
Wisdom.
They're totally crossed. His base is non-separation of emptiness and relative kindness. The totality of totality and relativity. Non-separation. That's his base when he's sitting and his legs totally crossed. You see, some deities are sitting with one leg up and one leg down. That compassion is coming into the world based on a firm basis of wisdom. You see some deities standing on their left foot and with their right foot up, right? Touching their left foot. This is wisdom dancing with compassion, giving it energy for appearing in the world. Most often the legs, except for Hebajra, where there are four legs and they represent the four activities, which are generosity, what is it? Generosity,
peace, prosperity. Peace, prosperity, wrath, and seduction, and the ones that are
no
made.
Generosity, dharma. I can't remember.
Related to the dhyana, or whatever you call it, the
No, Hebajra has four legs, right? And there are four activities: material giving, giving dharma.
But there's the four vows related protection. To the four.
No, not talking about that, Jeff. Okay. I'm talking about the meaning of his four legs. I'm just talking about the general symbolism of the Tibetan. Some people find the Tibetan tradition very difficult. I'm just saying, if you actually understand it, it's a way. It's a symbolic language of things that you already know.
So the legs, I seem to remember you said with the arms, it was the right that was wisdom and the left that was compassion. That's the other way around.
No, the right is compassion.
Oh.
The left is wisdom.
Okay.
This is the one that are mostly right-handed. This is where you do things in the world. But they can vary depending on the deity. Some female deities, some male deities. It varies.
Okay.
I'm giving general rules here. And then usually if you study any of the sadhanas, like Hebajra's 16 arms represent the 16 stages of emptiness. The first stage of emptiness, which is first arm is holding a bowl with a white elephant, and it's facing in, a skull cup with a white elephant.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is holding a yellow goddess of wealth, and she's facing out, and they're like this.
Mm-hmm.
The right hand is in. And he is taking in from all beings. his having himself understood that there is no fixed identity, no inherent self. Then he is also taking in all of the suffering of everybody who is suffering from being, oh, I'm better than, I'm worse than, or I'm equal to. And instead he's handing out the wealth of prosperity, of joy to everyone. So that's what that those that's what those two. And why can he do that? Because he doesn't know there's no inner fixed identity and there's no outer fixed identity. If there's no outer fixed identity, you can give everything to everybody all the time. Okay. Hmm. I think that's funny. Mm-hmm. I had this weird sense of humor.
What was his name again?
Hevajra, Hevajra. Is one of them. There are initiations that are called highest yoga tantra, and Hevajra is one. There's also a Vajra Yogini who is the highest yoga tantra. She's that red hot dancing tomato, and always nude. Bones all over her, and drinking. She's a bloodaholic. Drinking the nectar of bliss. Green Tara. She's usually got one leg down, doesn't she? Mm-hmm. Sitting with one leg down, because it's the light leg of activity in the world.
Yeah. Getting ready to get up and do something.
She's always her main movement is toward compassion. Compassionate activity. Mm-hmm. White Tara has both her legs crossed because she's being. Green Tara is knowing. She tends to be very intellectual. She loves to have theories. Tell me to shut up anytime. Ask me why I'm not talking about Manjushri.
What's Manjushri?
There are so many Manjushris. Did you know that?
Yeah, I heard that. There's a lot of them.
Oh, there's so many of them.
And you're all of them, right?
Well, Sonam, when I was given my Yidam, does this interest you? You want to hear personal stories? Oh, well, I didn't bother going to ask for my Yidam right away when Namjal Rinpoche, or Nanda Bodhi, Namjal Rinpoche, yeah, then. We were going to New Zealand to do a 3-month retreat after we had been to India and received an amazing teaching from His Eminence Shojit at the Sakya Center, which was brand new there. We received the round of 40 empowerments that is called the Garland of Roses or something that's just incredibly rarely given, and we have got there and he gave Choje Trichen, who died a couple of years ago, gave them all. Wonderful, one of the heads of the Sakya school, and as well as Sakya Trizing, gave us all kinds of initiations. And then after that, we went up and met His Holiness the Karmapa. That's when Namjal was given named as a Toku, and then went and met His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and then we were going to go and do a retreat in New Zealand, but I had been living in Thailand, in Japan, and Thailand before that, and before that, Rinpoche had got everybody to start doing the foundation work, and meanwhile, I'm living in Japan, where you don't do foundation work. And then in Thailand, where you don't do foundation work. So I joined the group in India, in Morocco, and then we go to India. And you couldn't do the retreat until you'd finished 50,000 prostrations, and 50,000, and I hadn't done any. And so, but we had 3 months in Australia before the retreat started. And you were supposed to have done 100,000. And I'm like, I had got some kind of disease in India. So I was very ill when we first got to Australia. So then we got to New Zealand, and for the first 2 weeks I wasn't allowed to join, and then he made an exception for me and invited me to enjoying the meditation. And then he's giving out idams, and I didn't bother asking for my idam because I already knew who it was. You know, I'm very clever in those things. I knew it was Vajrapani. So I didn't bother, you know, because I didn't want to bother him. There were so many people there. And he was, you know, always being, you know, so I didn't bother. But then everybody, pretty well everybody there had asked for their idam, and they're saying to me, why don't you ask for your idam? And I'm not going to tell them that I know, because that would seem too conceited, or, you know, like, I thought I was better than them or something, you know, and I didn't want to do that. I'm very careful about those things, you understand. So I said, oh yeah, well, yeah, I'll do that. So like finally, just about everybody in the group had asked me when I was going to ask for my idam, and he was giving a white tar, and I thought, oh, this is a good time. So I went out and sat beside him. Everybody had left the room. I went out and sat beside him. I was sitting and waiting, and he was just sitting there. He always knew when to do that. I just sat there and waited. And I went out and said, Venerable Sir, I wonder, would you be so kind as to give me my idam? He looks at me and he smiles. And I'm sitting there and I'm looking up at him, and he's going to say, you know, Vajrapani. And he says, Manjushri. And he closes his eyes. This rage comes up my whole body. This, I'm sitting there going, first I thought, oh, that's wrong. No, I was very calm because I knew. No, first I was, that's right, I lied there. I was very calm because I knew it was Vajrapani. So I just sat patiently and waited because I knew he would open his eyes and say, oh, no, I'm sorry. You know, I was sweating. And he opens his eyes again and he says, peaceful! And that's right. This rage comes up my whole body as soon as he says peaceful. And I say, thank you, sir. And I get up. And I start walking out of the room. And everybody's waiting. Because they want to know who my fucking idam is. And they go, oh, you asked for your idam? Yes. Oh, I didn't get it. Manjushri. Oh, wow. Oh, which one? I don't know. I finally get out the door. And I get out the door, and I'm on the path, and I'm going to go over to where I'm staying. And there's this young woman that had joined us in India, and, you know, she wasn't really spiritual. She just needs a group to travel with, you know. And she just happened to come. I knew she didn't really have, you know, the same love of Dharma as, you know, some of us had. But she had joined the group, and, you know, I gave her money when she was broken. And she's standing in the middle of the path. She's got one hand behind her back. And she's a real cheeky, you know. I knew about them. And she says, you asked for your yidam, didn't you? I said, yes. Oh, and who did our holy guru give you? Peaceful Jushri. I knew it. Look what I bought you in India. And she's got a peaceful Manjushri tonka that is absolutely beautiful.
Thank you. And I walk back to my room and I throw it in the floor
in the bed. And I sit there and I decide I'm going to do Vajrapani. And it took me 3 months before I did my practice of Manjushri. 3 months. It's not that I was stubborn, you understand. It's just that I was impenetrable. And then Sonam started deciding he knew which Manjushri was my idam, and there's so many of them. You know, there's the 12 Manjushri, there's orange, there's green, there's red, there's black, you know, there's two arm, four arm, eight arm, there's like, you wouldn't believe how many Manjushris there are. And so Sonam was doing translations in those days of the sadhanas. We got all kinds of teaching and sadhanas from His Holiness Sakyatrizing, and Sonam was translating them, and I would type them up. And Sonam was in India for part of that time. And every once in a while I'd get a letter from him. He'd say, oh, I know this one is your Yidam, and it would be one Manjushri. And then a few months later I'd get another, oh, this is, sorry, the last one, but this is your, and he kept giving me these ones. And then finally he, I got a phone call from him, and he says, Cecily, I realize I've sent you several sadhanas of Manjushri that I thought was your one. And so I asked Rinpoche which piece of Manjushri was your Yidam. And I said, well, what'd he say? What'd he say? Well, he said, well, maybe all of them are, so now. So not only do I have Manjushri, but I may have all of them. And you know what? Manjushri is absolutely right on. That is most important for me to learn to use. Oh my gosh. Blah, blah. Was that an interesting little bit of biography to know exactly what you were lucky enough to miss before I finally was tamed? So any last questions, answers, comments, or complaints? I got stories about all of everybody. You know, I'm saying, you want to know anything about
So can you explain what any down is?
Yidam is, there are these different deities that represent a power or a talent or a particular trait. You know, people have particular traits. And a Yidam is like each of the deities represent a quality of a human consciousness. And one that is particularly a good one for that person to work with would be called their Yidam. It's sort of like their... They're the one that will bring out their talents in the best way for them to make progress on the path.
Thank you. And so that's Green Tower for you? That's what you...
21 Green Tower.
21 Green Tower. Green Tower, yeah.
5.1.
And they're all about learning how to use all the elements.
Yeah.
Earth, water, fire, air, and all combinations thereof.
So there's Green Tower up there.
And then
yes.
Cecily, could you
in there
get a different Yidam from different...
Probably, but you usually wouldn't ask that often.
Okay.
Yeah, probably. My beloved teacher had an incredible eye for people. And some teachers are very beautiful teachers, but more often they give a general Yidam.
Okay.
You know, that, well, this would be a good one for you to work with, but it isn't necessarily. And you notice that I do have a kind of a mind that goes for the precision of the fact. Have you noticed that about me?
Mm-hmm.
I tend to... And I also tend to try to be fairly neutral. Would you say that's true?
Mm-hmm.
But was that not so much a trait back then? Is it something you've developed? Or?
No, it's something I've always had. Yeah. When the neighbor boys next door would start teasing my sisters and fighting with them, and my sisters would start teasing and fighting back, and then both of them would barely be able to go out the door without the other one attacking. I would go over to my neighbor's door and knock, this son, like I'm 7 years old, knock on their door and tell them they should really come out and talk to my sisters, and then go back to my sisters and go in my house and say to my sisters, you should really come out and talk to, you know. Always trying to find the middle ground for everybody to meet. I had a black eye once from doing.
We didn't really identify that as a strength, like when you were...
It was just one of the things that I was just moved to do.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's curious you didn't... You thought Rinpoche was wrong. It was not...
Well, I have no idea. That was Manjushri at his worst. Yeah.
It was a strong...
Vajrapani means, yeah.
You're very
attached. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, because when I think that something is right, I have had to learn to pry at the fingers of that grasping and consider why I think it, rather than just being so satisfied with my own answer. And that's taken a while to learn. Is that enough? Blah, 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 you know. Huh? Any last questions, answers, comments, or complaints, or are we done? We're done.
I think I'm done.
So you notice you notice this beautiful gold light in your hearts, and it just spreads through your body. Moves out your head, down your toes, your back, your front. Fills the room, fills the house. Goes through all of Edmonton, all of north part of North America, right through the whole earth, everywhere, above, below, in front, behind, right, left, four quarters. Wherever there is any suffering, anybody you want to pray for. Wherever there is any suffering of body, speech, and mind, the light just moves out from all of us. Assuage all suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. So thank you for your great compassion.
Sadhu.
Andy Maho.